and welcome back to Stories from the Ashes, where we pontificate on good books and the stories that define and refine us. I am your host, Amber, and I am here today with a special guest, author Ellie Swartz. Welcome, Ellie.
Thank you so much, Amber, for inviting me on to the podcast. I love your podcast. I love all the good you put out into the world. So thank you for having me.
Well, we're really excited to have you here. So you have a new book coming out, I believe, is it October 31st?
Yes.
Is that the release date for Hidden Truths? How exciting. But other people may recognize your writing from your book, Give and Take, that I have talked about multiple times here on the podcast. And we will probably touch on that soon. But could you let us get to know you a little bit by telling us three of your favorite books, or books that have just been really influential in your life?
Sure. I love that question as a way to get to know somebody. So for me, the first one is probably the Ramona the Brave from when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I love her spunky self. I love that she is a girl with a voice who is not afraid to use it. Yeah. I just love that about her, and I connected with that as a kid. The next one is Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret by Judy Blum. I am an only daughter of, I have two older brothers, and I kind of felt like that book was like my big sister kind of talking to me. Mm-hmm. And I also felt as a writer when I came into writing that Judy Blum's voice and the cadence and heart of her stories was something that really touched me and inspired me as a writer and influenced my writing as well. And then lastly, I would say McHart Was Here has to be on that list. McHart Was Here is this book by Barbara Park. It is thin. It is 80 some pages. It was a book that my son, who is now going to be 31, when he was in fifth grade, it was assigned to him to read. We read it out loud together, and it made me laugh. It made me cry. It made me feel all the feels. And when we were done reading it, I turned to him and said, and my family, and said, "Oh my God, this is what I want to do. I want to write books for kids." And then just 15 years later, my first book came out.
That's awesome.
So those are the books that kind of, there are so many. I mean, I could continue, but there are, I think those touched my heart in all different ways at different times of my life.
That's very cool. I've never even heard of that book, which is always a shocker to me. Well, usually like when people have a top three book. Yeah. I think this is only the second top three book that an author has shared with us that I have not heard of. So yeah, so that's exciting. Do you remember the first book that made you cry?
So I have kind of a terrible memory,
yeah.
but I would say when I was thinking about this question, I kept going back to Charlotte's Web. Mm. I think that is the book that I remember most that made me cry when I was younger reading it.
Yeah.
It just hurt my heart in a lot of ways. I mean, there was a lot about it that was obviously very positive and joyful, but there was a lot about it that just felt really sad to me. So I would have to say Charlotte's Web.
That's a beautiful one. Have you ever heard the audiobook read by the author?
No. Oh my gosh. I have to listen to that. Am I going to cry?
You are going to cry. And the part that always gets me is the fact that he said it took like 15 to 20, I think, takes to get the like end section that makes people cry because it was making him cry. And I was just like, if the author is still that moved by the story they told, you know how real it was for them and that they weren't just making a paycheck, you know, like obviously some authors are just writing something they were assigned or something that their heart isn't in. Like the second half of Little Women, the author, Louise May Alcott, was like instructed to write more of the story and she didn't want to. And I think that the cadence and the flow of the second half of that, you can tell. her heart wasn't in it in the same way as the story she wanted to tell. And so I just love how in Charlotte's Web, like, you can tell he wanted to tell this story the way he told it. And it touched him and it touches generations.
Well, I love, upon us leaving this podcast, you're going to read McHart Was Here, and I'm going to listen to Charlotte's Web, and then we'll have to reunite and share how we felt.
Yes, definitely. Do you have a book that you consider to be just, well, I guess your third book that you had mentioned is your three favorite books that I hadn't even heard about. But other than that one, do you have a book that you consider to be a really underappreciated novel?
That was the one that really comes to mind.
Yeah.
Won all these awards and was incredibly well received when it came out, which came out in 95. But as I have talked about this book in a lot of my presentations, school visits, currently nobody has known of it. And I just think it is such an incredible book that I hope makes a resurgence again. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, great for reluctant readers in the sense that it's short, but it really is such a great book that instructs writing in a wonderful way because you really feel all the feels. And it's about a sister who is telling the story about her brother who actually died when he was riding his bike without his bike helmet. Mm-hmm. But there is humor in it. There is so much love, like you were talking about, the heart clearly on the pages of this story. So I think that this book, not that it was underappreciated when it came out, but that was a long time ago, but I would hope that people could find it again because I just think it is a really special story in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, we will definitely be adding it to the show notes and we will see if it gets a nice little resurgence. That would be great. I love seeing your bookshelves behind you, and Reshelving Alexandria, which is our main community, is a community of home library builders. So I'm just wondering, with your own personal home library, do you intentionally seek out certain titles and curate to certain themes or ideas, or do you just believe that the right books will find you and let the books come to you as they will?
What's so funny about that question is I never even thought about curating in that way. I just read what I'm drawn to, or I also, as a member of the KidLit community, think it's so important to read other KidLit authors, to support other KidLit authors. So a lot of my reading, people, friends of mine always ask me, you know, if I've read this adult book, and I'm like, not really. Yes. I mean, honestly, if it's not for a 9 to 12 year old, the chances are pretty good I haven't read it. So for me, I feel like the books that are right for me do find me. In supporting other authors that are in my community, I also, fill my shelves with, wonderfully talented KidLit writers.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I'm sure, especially with how lovely covers are, that you have a very rainbow colored spine collection with all the KidLit. It's probably just very aesthetically pleasing.
Well, I'm always so envious when I go on Instagram and I see people who've got their bookshelves that are color coded like the rainbow. And I'm like, oh my God, that's amazing. I mean, mine don't look like that. But usually I fill my shelves with all these books that I love. I buy a lot of my KidLit friend, a lot of their books. And then I obviously have over, and there's only so much room in my house and my bookshelves. So with the overflow, I usually pack up boxes a couple times a year and send them either to libraries in need or classrooms. So I, kind of pay it forward.
Yes, that's a great thing to do with your beautiful overflow. So the books that you write that I have read, so I've read two of your books now. I've read Give and Take, and then I did read the advanced reader copy for Hidden Truths. And then my daughter Inara, who's 16, she's read all of your books except the one that our library doesn't have, so she just plowed through them after she read Give and Take. But your books, in our experience, heavily focus on emotional intelligence. And so my question is, why? Why is that what you chose to focus on? If Google is to be believed, you studied psychology and received a law degree. Is that your background?
Yes. So first of all, tell your daughter, Inara, I said thank you. So that means a lot to me. So Google is to be believed. I did study psychology in college, and I did get a law degree and practice law for a number of years. All of that is true. Emotional intelligence to me, I mean, I write about social emotional learning and emotional intelligence because to me, it's really the foundation upon which everything else is built. It's how we discover who we are, how we accept who we are, how it's the basis of kindness and empathy. To me, it's sort of our life raft and our bridge. It's the foundation and it's the ladder. I don't know how to explore story and have it not reflect emotional intelligence and social emotional learning. I mean, I feel like heart is really at the cornerstone of the books I write, and it starts with a character. And I feel like that really is the foundation for everything. So I don't know how to incorporate, I don't know how to write story without it.
Yeah.
For me, it's very integral to the way I approach writing, but also the way I approach life.
Yeah. I like that. Being an adult who has adult children and is now seeing yet another generation of kids coming up. So that's three generations of, you know, you were a kid, your kids were kids, and now kids. What resources are you seeing that you had as a kid that maybe kids today don't have, or vice versa, resources that kids today have that you didn't have? What has been your observations there?
My observations are that the resources today are plentiful, much more plentiful than they were when I was growing up. I'm 57. So it's a very different generation, and the conversations are very different. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that the conversations around neurodiversity and mental health are happening more and more in schools, at dinner tables. Mm-hmm. I think that therapy and, you know, seeking out counsel is something that kids and families are doing more without hesitation and shame and embarrassment. I think we're working harder to break down those stigmas and stereotypes that have historically and traditionally surrounded mental health and neurodiversity. Mm-hmm. I think we still have a long way to go, but we are making inroads. And I think, you know, when I grew up, fortunately, I had an incredibly loving family. And so love and family were my resources. And I think those are still plentiful in the world today, but I'm glad there are other tools that families can have in their toolbox.
I do really appreciate how you have been touching on neurodiversity and normalizing therapy in your books. That was one of the things that really touched me in Give and Take, was that when Maggie was struggling, her parents got her into therapy and they went together as the first step, and that it was just this completely okay thing to do. This is just like eating our vegetables. This is how we take care of this situation and take care of ourselves and acquire tools for dealing with harder, complicated situations. And then in Hidden Truths, Eric has undiagnosed ADHD, which I loved. And I also really loved the fact that you never gave him a diagnosis in the story, because that's so true to so many kids' experience. Unfortunately, they don't get the diagnosis and then they don't get the support that they need. But because we have generations that came up that way and then we're still struggling to get diagnosis, it's just important for kids to understand that it's okay for them to click differently and tick differently than the kids around them, and that it's okay for them to... I highlighted so much of this book. There were so many things that I was just like, yes, I want to like make sure that I point this out to my kids when I read it to them. And I think one of the things that I especially appreciated about Hidden Truths was it felt like the language was more simplified, even from Give and Take, which is going to be very helpful for my neurodiverse kids that have auditory processing challenges and have language challenges, to just be a really powerful story that's simply told, that's accessible to them. So my son is dealing with, he's 11, he's autistic, and he's dealing with some bullying in a kids group that he's in, where every Wednesday night when he shows up, this little group of girls says, "Here comes Mr. Weirdo." And we just found this out at the end of last season. And so we're like waiting for this fall to start up. So we've been talking about it all summer. But I really liked Eric having to deal with bullies in this story, male and female. And that, because I think often we see like physical bullying for boys in books, but we don't always see that female verbal bullying that can happen. And so I was really glad to see that. I'm very much looking forward to sharing this book with my son. And I also want to say what we've decided to do for Knightley, my 11-year-old. So my Inara, our eldest, she saw this sweatshirt that she wanted for dance this fall, because she's the only homeschooled kid in her dance club. And so she just feels like there's this everybody's weird to her, just like she's weird to them. And she embraces it and she thinks it's awesome. And so the big bald eagle from the Muppets, who has that one scene in the Muppet Show where he like throws open the door and walks in and says, "You are all weirdos," and then slams the door and leaves again. They made it into a shirt. And so she was like, "I want that shirt." And we were like, actually, Knightley probably should get that shirt. So we sold, like, we've been talking with Knightley so much about how everybody's weird. And I really appreciate the messaging that other people have given to that. A friend just sent me a short interview with Ed Sheeran, the musician, where he talks about how he was a weird kid, how he had a port wine stain on his face, birthmark. And after the lasering of it, the medication they gave him, they skipped a dose and it resulted in him developing a stutter. And so then he had this stutter that he was trying to outgrow, and he was really dealing with like the fact that he was weird and different. And my kids love Ed Sheeran because Ed Sheeran had the good sense to do music for the Hobbit soundtrack, and they're Lord of the Rings fans, and like they all love Tolkien, and so they know Ed Sheeran from the Hobbit soundtrack. And so I was able to like sit down with my 11-year-old, and this was a male voice able to speak to this "we are all weird" belief. And so he really seems like he's gathering some confidence to go back and face these girls this fall with the message of, it's okay. You might think I'm weird, and I'm okay with that. And by the way, you're probably a little weird too. Right.
We're all weird. Yeah. So now I'm going to give you another book. You have to read your and read it with your son.
You actually, you like blipped out right when you said the title. Could you say it one more time for me?
You have to read Dear Student.
Okay.
My book that came out in 2022.
That is the one book my library did not have. So we will buy it.
So it is about a girl with social anxiety who becomes the secret voice of the middle school advice column. But there's a large part of the story that is about being weird and being good weird.
Okay.
And that thematically, plus, and I should say this, share about all of my books, have curriculum guides and educate like on my website that have, you know, for homeschooling or for if you're in a building, I mean, whatever kind of, formalized education you have, you're welcome to just download them. But that notion of being good weird, I feel like weird is, when I looked at the definition, it was, you know, strange or extraordinary. Uh-huh. And it's like, why as a culture have we leaned into strange?
Right.
I mean, what extraordinary? Like, I'm all over that. I don't want to be like everybody else. I want to be uniquely, wonderfully, weirdly me. Mm-hmm. And so tell your son, I am hands down with him on being hashtag good weird. So then the other thing you mentioned about the bullying in Hidden Truths, it was really important to me because to do a number of things, but one was the idea that the world doesn't define us and that we are so much more than the labels that are put upon us, whether it's Danny and baseball, whether it's Eric and ADHD, it doesn't, we are not what other people don't get to define our worth. Right. And so whatever you have, mental health challenges, neurodiverse, you know, just an interest in a particular sport, you are not that label. Mm-hmm. You are so much more than what somebody puts upon you. You get to decide your worth. You get to decide who you are. So never let anybody determine or say that you are who you are and what that label is for you. And the aspect of bullying and how many different forms it can take, you know, and with social media, you have cyberbullying and Eric experiences that. He experiences the physical, the traditional, the, you know, oh, I'm just joking or use your sense of humor, you know, that type of interaction. And then just the notion of silence. You know, when a friend, when somebody has the opportunity to stand up for you and they make a choice not to, that element of whether it's actual bullying in the legal term or it's still the same. And so I wanted to explore all those different aspects of what it means to be bullied and to bully and how that feels.
Yeah. With the silence, at the very least, it's betrayal. And that's its own pain.
Yeah. Yes.
Within a relationship. So what advice would you give your younger self?
I would tell myself to just be me, to just be who I am. And at times that's like goofy and weird. And all of that is okay. I mean, it's just who you are, just accept who you are. And then I would also tell myself not to eat ice cream because ultimately I'd find out I was allergic.
Oh no.
And that's why I had all the stomach aches.
Oh, that's too bad. So sad. So Hidden Truths was actually, I believe, your first book that you started writing, and it just didn't click for you 22 years ago. And so you came back to it.
I started it. It was the first book I wrote. So after my son and I read McHeart Was Here by Barbara Park, that summer I wrote my first book, and it was actually called at the time A Promise Between Friends. Mm-hmm. And it was written solely from the perspective of Eric. Mm-hmm. And I submitted it. I got rejection after rejection. I went on to write 4 more books. And my 5th book was Finding Perfect. And that was the first book of mine that sold in 2016. But some stories, Amber, you just can't walk away from.
Yeah.
And so every few years I would go back to what is now Hidden Truths. Mm-hmm. And I would revise it, you know, because hopefully I'm continuing to learn, right? As an author, I'm growing, learning, I'm getting more tools, I'm becoming hopefully a better writer. So I would continue to go back in, and eventually I realized that the story wasn't just Eric's, that it was Danny's too. And I really needed her representation and her voice. Mm-hmm. So that led to me rewriting the story in pretty much its entirety. I really leaned into the changing friendship aspect of things and how friendships shift as kids go into middle school or throughout middle school, and the social media aspect and the bullying piece. And so ultimately that version of it sold, but it took 22 years, much rejection and much revision and reimagining. And, you know, you just, I think with story, if you're in this as a writer, you just have to keep learning and growing. You know, there's no place for ego, and just be willing to dive back in and get rid of a bunch of stuff that's not working and keep trying and fail. Be, you know, really the willingness to fail and realize it doesn't define you. Just like I said about the labels, like rejection didn't define me. I mean, it was a part of the process.
Yeah.
So having to be willing to look beyond that to continue to move forward in a positive direction.
Yeah.
And now it's coming out.
Yeah, it has. And I appreciate the fact that it was able to include something you wouldn't have 22 years ago, which was the social media aspect of cyberbullying. And I think that was, it made my heart sad to read that part, but it was true. You know, like I know kids that's happened to and that have struggled with that sort of thing. And so I'm glad that this book is there for parents to be able to have conversations with their kids. And it's, you know, it's part of the, I always talk about how in our community we're searching for books that are good, true, and beautiful. And you can't leave out the true. Like the true isn't always pretty. It doesn't always feel good, but it's part of good, true, and beautiful being that balance. And so this is one of those uncomfortable things. I will say, I think Hidden Truths is probably one of the most uncomfortable books that I've read this year in a good way. Like I was very unhappy with Danny for a whole lot of it. And I, you know, really felt for Eric, and I, you know, was stressed out by Danny's mom and how she was handling it. But I recognized it. I recognized how she was clearly dealing with her own trauma and her own stress and trying to be a good mom. And then I was glad that she and Danny were able to have a conversation at the end, and she was able to verbalize some of what her struggle had been, because again, I think it's really good for kids to hear it just clearly laid out and to know that what they're struggling with, there's probably adults struggling with the same thing in their own version, and that this is not unique to any one human experience. But,
and I think what I love what you said about beautiful, good, beautiful, and true. Was that those the pillars? Yep. I feel like that's all of us, right? There's parts of us that are good, parts of us that are beautiful. And the true piece has a lot of things that we navigate that are difficult.
Yeah.
Right? Like when you have a book, or when I write, I like to make sure, like in Hidden Truths, you're feeling all the feels, all the good stuff, the good and beautiful, but also those other emotions, because the truth is, kids feel them. We feel them. You know, we feel envy, we feel anger, we feel frustration.
Bitterness. I think bitterness is one,
betrayal, we feel entitlement. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we can have those emotions, as difficult as they may be, but as true as they are in a story, then we can show kids that it's okay to have those feelings and how to navigate them. Because if we never talk about the stuff that's uncomfortable, then we never teach our kids what to do with those emotions when they have them. They shouldn't feel shame about them, but they do need to understand what to do with them.
Yeah.
They need to have the tools. And I feel like story is one of those things. So I feel, I'm hopeful that Hidden Truths, although there are parts that are hard and uncomfortable, and it helps kids navigate those times. I mean, Danny was sidelined and hurting.
Yeah.
And this was how she, her hurt manifested. Mm-hmm. Was it right?
Right.
I'll leave that to the reader to work through. But was it true? Yes.
Yeah.
And it also shows when you have those times when you're maybe not being your best self, that you can also get to the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also like the element of when you're not your best self, who is still there with you?
Yes. Right.
Like, I mean, your family, within your friends. Yeah. Who is willing to embrace all the facets that are you?
Right.
And not just because the parts that serve them.
Right. I mean, friendship, like life, is not linear. Mm-hmm. And as you said before, it can be messy. I mean, it's easy to stand by somebody when everything is okay.
Yeah.
It's much harder to be a friend, a true friend, a forever friend, mm-hmm. when things get complicated.
Yeah. And I absolutely loved that aspect. It's one of my favorite aspects of give and take, because I don't see it very often in Kidlit, where the relationship hits a challenge between Maggie and a friend, and Maggie has to do the right thing and call out that that friend is cheating or going to cheat, and it causes a rift in the whole friend group, and you don't resolve it. Like, that is so powerful to me, because in the book groups that I run in, a lot of times people are like, we talk a lot about books as mirrors and books as windows. And I've started talking as a neurodivergent as books as mentors. And so mm-hmm. I really feel that, and as mentors and models, and I really feel that the modeling in that relationship is so important, because I think that in Kidlit, we can sometimes come away with, as a kid, with this mistaken belief that everything is going to work out okay, and that if we do the right thing, then everyone will understand and it'll be okay. Kind of like Eric in Hidden Truths. He's like, once this report is out that says what really happened in this situation, everything will go back to normal. And it didn't. And so I think that there's this value to seeing that when you do the right thing, there are sometimes heavy costs that you may not even foresee. Like, she may have foreseen that things might go south with that friend if she did the right thing, but didn't realize like it would affect other friendships too. But she did it. She did the hard thing, the right thing, and then she has to live with the consequences. And consequences aren't always because you did something wrong. Often they're because you did something right.
That's I will be interested when you read Dear Student. There is no spoilers, but I think you'll appreciate sort of the a similar approach. I think, and when I'm writing, I think it's really important to me to be hopeful, mm-hmm. but to also be real and to let kids know that things are not all rainbows and unicorns. Not everything yeah. is tied up neatly in a bow. That isn't life. Mm-hmm. There is hope, because for me, that is the lens from which I write. I think that's yeah. a lot of times the difference between middle grade and young adult. Mm-hmm. And it's also just the space that I take up. I mean, it's important to, in life and on the page. I am an incredibly hopeful person.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that there aren't messy moments. And right. it doesn't mean that everything isn't neatly tied up, mm-hmm. but it does mean that there is hope. Yeah. So, but I like to do both of those things, because I think mm-hmm. kids need to see that, as you said, even if you're doing the right thing,
yeah,
even you know, things don't always go as you would hope.
Yeah. So, how much of your writing would you say is research versus personal experience?
I think it's a really good complement of both. I mean, there's no one character in my book that I pluck from life. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, people would stop hanging out with me.
Yeah.
They thought they were just going to end up on the pages of my books. Mm-hmm. But except pets, a lot of the pets we've had in our family. But I feel like, you know, in every book, all of the emotions, you know, the ones we're proud of, as we were talking about, and the ones we're all working on, those are mine. Those are authentically my emotions that I have experienced. And those are all very real. I mean, it's important to me to write from that place, that really authentic place. Mm-hmm. And so tapping into the emotions that you've had in your life, that I've had and experienced in my life, the things I've gone through, it's really important to tap into those so that the characters' experiences are real.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I talk about that I have anxiety. So a lot of that aspect comes from those emotions that I've experienced, but my characters are not me. So I think, you know, pulling from aspects of your life, people who know me and who've grown up with me are like, oh my God, I remember that, or I know this. Or, you know, we had a dog named Casey growing up. We had the red bucket of balls for baseball. Like, we had that. Like, there are things in the story that my in Smart Cookie, there is a snow globe collection that was actually my son's, and that haunted house thing, that haunted ghost element came from a true thing. But there are, so there's like sprinkling. Mm-hmm. So it's a good blend. And there's a ton of research I do for all of my books. This book in particular, I worked with a therapist who works with kids with ADHD. I work with a doctor on Danny's injuries. I worked with a physical therapist on her recovery. I worked with a Consumer Product Safety Commission for the aspect of the explosion, relating to a product. And I worked with fire and rescue in terms of the fire. So it's really important to me that all the details of my story are authentic and accurate. Mm-hmm. And research, even in fiction, I mean, I think there's so many of us that research. Part of it is my lawyer self, but making sure that all the details are accurate, because I want kids to, it's important to honor them and to respect my reader enough to make sure that I'm getting all the details right.
I think that you did a very, very good job with the ADHD. I was able to pick that out right away. And I was like, oh, I think this is his journey. I don't think he understands. And that's a really hard place to be.
I also, you know, that's in my world as well. And I really wanted him to see himself, see his ADHD also as his superpower. I know that there are aspects of it that are very hard for Eric. Mm-hmm. And I understand and respect and honor that. But there are also parts of it that being able to do the deep dive, being able to see the world sideways, all the different ways that people can't, I think that is such a gift. And I know it's hard in traditional school settings for all of those things to be appreciated, but I hope we're moving in a direction where all kids who learn in all different ways are respected and honored.
Yeah. There was a part that I underlined that was talking about rabbit holes and how when you have fallen into the bottom of the rabbit hole, the view is different and you can see the problem differently from down there. And I was like, that's so true. Like, it is. It's a completely different perspective. And when you're in the bottom of five rabbit holes at the same time.
There's a part in the book where, you know, it goes through an editorial process. And there was a part that one of the people who was editing it it was the rabbit hole scene and about shortening some of it. And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is what happens. Yeah. So it's really important to me that the way Eric's brain works is reflected in the story in its fullest. And I don't want to shorten it, because that wouldn't be respectful of Eric's brain and his experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the growth arc that he is in of self-discovery. Like, we needed to hear about it and hear his different realizations. Yeah. And I thought it was beautiful how he was moving into like leadership positions and how he was feeling empowered as a leader to be able to do it, even though it looked different than other people. I also thought that it would be really fun to have a counter to see how many times they eat donuts in this book, because I am gluten-free and I reached the end of the book and I was really just like, dude, I really want a donut. And now everything looks like a donut. I was at a bagel shop earlier today and all the bagels looked like donuts. And I was like, I said, it's the, It's hidden truths. Oh, that's God. Why I'm so fixated on donuts right now.
To be honest, I am I'm dairy free, as I said earlier, uh-huh. and I'm also gluten free. So yeah. We need to just. There was a they made cupcakes, like gluten and dairy free cupcakes. I'm sure we can find some gluten and dairy free yes. donuts that wouldn't just be like a mirage.
Yeah. So what, I'm sure you've touched on this in a bunch of little tiny pieces, but just succinctly, like, what do you think makes a good story?
Heart.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's where it starts for me. Mm-hmm. That's if I'm reading a book, whether it's mine and I'm working on it or somebody else's.
Yeah.
It's always heart. I mean, that's my measure. Is it tugging at my heart? Is it imprinting on my heart? Those are the things that matter to me as a writer and as a reader. So for me, it's really simple. It's heart.
Yeah. I love that. What advice do you have for young writers?
Read. Mm-hmm. Just like anything, right? You want to learn how to play basketball, you play basketball.
Right.
Like that's how you learn. If you want to learn how to write, read. Read, you know, reading books is like having your own personal coach, right? Yeah. You're reading mentor texts. And I don't want you to take a book and do what they do. I want you to take a book and be inspired and then do your own thing. Mm-hmm. I would say read and then write what matters to you. Like write, you know, going back to that heart piece, when you're writing, I think the most effective writing is the writing that shrinks the space between you as the writer and the reader, right? Like that space gets really small. And so that your experiences are going, your character's experiences are going right to like your reader's heart and head. And so the way to do that is to really write what matters to you, because if you're writing what matters to you, it's really coming from that place of true authenticity.
Yeah.
And then I guess the last thing I would share with young writers is fail. Like go for it, because you're going to stumble, you're going to fall. Some of things are going to be great. I call my first draft Swiss cheese. It has holes and things. I already know going in, it's going to do that. I'm not stressed. There's not like heavy weight on me that, oh my God, it's got to be perfect. It's not going to be perfect. You are going to fail. Some things you write are going to stink. And that's okay, because you need to do that to get better. You need to do that to get to the other side, to get to those great moments. And then I guess my last piece of advice would be to celebrate everything. A great word, a great idea. Don't wait to the product to celebrate. Mm-hmm. If I waited, I mean, I never would have gotten there, Amber. 15 years. I mean, that would have been so long. So I celebrate everything. Like you're worth it. Celebrate the journey. The journey is a wonderful gift in and of itself. Don't wait to cross the finish line.
That's beautiful. We had a guest on, Hutch. He writes survivalist books and he's a survivalist specialist and so fascinating. But something that he talks about is on his bookshelf, if his wife made him reduce all of his books in certain categories to just 6 to 8 inches on a topic, what would he have there? And so I had convinced him to read Echo Mountain by Lauren Wolk, and he loved it. And he said it was going to go right next to my side of the mountain and that that would now be in one of his 6 to 8 inches of survivalist fiction. So for you, if you had to have 6 to 8 inches of books just focused on emotional intelligence and full of heart in that way, what would be your, these would absolutely be there
type. Okay. So this is my list. I don't know if this is 6 to 8 inches worth, but okay, so mine, hopefully, but maybe this would be on a different shelf. All right, these are the ones that I would put there. I narrowed it down as much as I could.
Perfect.
Okay, so Francisco Stork's Marcella in the Real World, Rain Rain by Anne M. Martin, Sharon Draper, Out of My Mind, Ghost Brothers by Joel Parker Rhodes, The Bridge Home by Padma Venkatraman, Fish in a Tree by Linda Mullally Hunt, The Truth is Told by Mason Buttle by Leslie O'Connor, A Work in Progress by Jarrett Lerner. I'm Worried by Debbie Ohai. And then When Things Don't Go Right, Go Left by Mark C. I'm blanking on his last name, and Peter Reynolds. So those would be my 6 to 8 inches. I may have taken a little more than 6 to 8 inches. But
might be 8 to 12. Oh, good. Yeah. 6 to 8 inches of titles on the Kindle, right?
Exactly. Who's measuring?
Yeah. No, that's great. I don't know some of those titles, so I'm excited to check them out from the library and give them a read. So the last question that we have that we've started asking people, just because everyone is so different and unique in their experiencing and how they process through things. But when you are in a wintering season and just completely feel underwater, what is something that you do for self-care?
I would say my self-care falls into three categories. One is move. It's really important to me, ideally, to be in nature and walking or hiking or skiing or snowshoeing or any, depending on what season it is. But if I'm having a hard time, if I need some space, brain space, heart space, getting out in nature is one of the things that I do. I actually start every day, I walk my dogs. So I'm a very big, I've always been a huge nature person. I love the outdoors. So being outside kind of refuels my soul. So that's one. The other is giving myself grace. Yeah. I think it's, we talk a lot about kindness in the world, and that is so important. But I think of equal importance is self-kindness. And I feel that is really often overlooked. So if I'm having a hard time, I try to do one nice thing for myself. Nice. And then the last piece is I do try to do one kind thing for somebody else. I think doing something nice for somebody always makes you feel better. So that's kind of my recipe. They're my triangle of self-care.
I love that. And Ara and I call doing kind things for other people spreading joy and sunshine.
I love that.
We just call it joy and sunshine. And she made fun of me because one of the things that I love to do is let people know when they have a headlight out, because it's a ticketable offense and nobody wants that hassle. Wants to have the danger of not knowing that their headlights are on. So I'll pull up alongside cars and wave at them to roll down their window. And so now whenever we're driving and we see a car that has a headlight out, and Ara just yells at them as they go past, joy and sunshine.
Oh, I love that. See, if everyone just knew what joy and sunshine were, the world would be a much better place. If everyone practiced that. Yes. I love that.
So, and then I have a song recommendation for you on the self-kindness. Andrew Peterson wrote a song for his daughter, and it's called Be Kind to Yourself. And one of the parts of it that I really love is the line, because, we always say that we need to be kind to our enemies. And then there's also the concept of sometimes you are your own worst enemy. And so there's a line in the song that says, you have to learn to love your enemies too. And it's talking about yourself. And it's if we see ourselves as our enemies, if we also embrace loving our enemies, then we have to be kind to ourselves even when we are our own worst trouble at the moment.
I love it. Who sings that? Who's the
Andrew
artist?
Peterson. He's also the author of the Wing Feather Saga. I don't know if you've seen that one at all. It just became a TV show in the last year. It just wrapped up season one of a really nice cartoon.
Now I feel like I have so many things to check out.
Yeah, he's a songwriter, and then he wrote this series of books. And so the music in it is obviously amazing. But I just whenever people talk about being kind to themselves, I just think of Andrew's song, and we always play it around here whenever anyone's being down on themselves. Somebody will just turn that song on nice. So that they can have that be their self-thought. So thank you so much, Ellie, for coming on and sharing about your stories and your writing experience. We really appreciate your time and your knowledge and experience.
Thank you so much for having me, Amber. It has been such a joy to be on here, to get to chat with you and to share. And it's just been wonderful. I really loved it. Thank you so much. I'm grateful to have been a part of this show.
Yeah, it was a true delight. So everyone, in the show notes, you will find links to Ellie's books and then all the books that she shared with us and a whole bunch of new titles to me and I'm sure to other people too. And Hidden Truths releases on October 31st. And remember, everybody, the stories are truer than true.